Now, you're over here for a very recent conversation. It was on religion in Canada, in the public square, as they called it, and you're one of the speakers there. A very interesting conversation, as it was called, which was nice. It made it more intimate. When you began your discourse, your address that morning, you started off on the use of terminologies. You talked about it, that it was a real challenge. Talk to me about that, the use of terminologies and how they can be used inappropriately when you're dealing with particular types of language. You did mention the word secularism as one example.
Yes. Well, I began, I think, by suggesting that we have to be extremely careful about the foundational or the basic terms we're using to describe the nature of the state and religions in relation to the state. I chose as a particular example, as a problem term, the term secular, the way it's currently used. I explained that within the Roman Catholic tradition, the term secular denoted the period of time, not a period, not an area of the culture or the society or the any part of our world that was desacralized, that was not holy. Within the Catholic Catechism, we recognize the division in clergy between regular and secular clergy, and we also recognize what we call secular institutes. In both cases, secular clergy and secular institutes, clearly secular does not mean non-religious. What it means is in the world. Now, that use of secular is no longer the way the term is used when we speak about religion and the secular. What's happened is, increasingly, we have adopted, if religious people use this formulation, a division between the secular realm and religion that is not recognized by the Catholic tradition, certainly, and makes very, very troublesome the articulation that's more appropriate, namely that religion has a place in the public square. The better term to use always is the term public sphere or public square, because religious belief and religious believers have as much right in that public square and public world as any other belief system. And the second point I made was that everybody's a believer. All citizens are believers, whether that belief is based on religious presuppositions or other ones. And by formulating things in terms of religion and the secular being non-religious, we've effectively given whatever the secular is over to atheism and agnosticism as dominant belief systems. And that's a big mistake.
How much does the media get bogged down in terminologies?
Yeah, I think the media has to be very careful that it doesn't play into formulations that, in a sense, drive the conclusion. So, for example, if we phrase a question in terms of, well, should religion have a place in the secular world, we've already anticipated a split in the very way we framed the question. From the perspective of the law, certainly the law in Canada and in South Africa, there is no legally recognized strict division between religion and the public square. By that I mean there's no reason why religious associations cannot have a role within the public. There's properly understood a cooperation between religions and the state, or the state being law and politics. There's a cooperation, not a separation. But if a person in the media raises the question to somebody, well, in a secular society, what role should religion have? They're immediately, by framing the idea of a secular society, they're predisposing a particular outcome in the question. I won't answer that question anymore. I'll say, well, what do you mean by a secular society? Are we speaking here about the public sphere? And when you speak about the public and then explain that everyone's a believer in the public, it's a very different approach to the question than if you presuppose a separation by calling it the secular world.
Looking to Pope Benedict XVI and the encyclicals that he's written, how interesting have you found those, and maybe his speeches, his addresses on this issue?
I haven't really, to be honest, spent time addressing those encyclicals. I've been focused mainly on Vatican II documents such as Dignitatis Humanae, which addresses specifically the role of the church in relation to the contemporary politics. I spent a lot of time in the encyclicals of John Paul II and was expressed concern about some of the language used there. The term values is another one I'm very, very concerned about, because it's not a term that is really has its roots in our tradition, in the richest formulation of what we talked about. In the modern age, you have your values, I have mine. They may overlap, they may not. That's just the way it is. But with virtues, which was the language and is the language of the tradition, really, the cardinal virtues, the theological virtues, there's a personal dimension to them, how it is with you and me in terms of our nature. But what we're talking about is an objective category that isn't up for grabs. We know that courage matters, wisdom matters, moderation matters, justice matters as things, whether or not we choose them. With values, that's not clear. I understand that what the Holy Father John Paul II was doing was attempting to reach a culture that was steeped in this values language. But I agree with the Canadian philosopher George Grant, who referred to values language as an obscuring language for morality used when the idea of purpose has been destroyed. That destruction of purpose for human beings and for all human beings towards categories of virtue and truth and goodness is a very big shift. And if the term values is being used in place of virtue or in place of objective categories of meaning, that's a very serious problem. Interestingly, I was informed by some of my friends who are scholars in this area that when the term values appeared in the writings of the church, when it goes back into the Latin, the term values cannot appear because the term it's put into is bonum, the good. So this Nietzschean language, post-Nietzschean language of values, as we use it, this economic commodification concept, I think is a troublesome term for moral use. And I hope it's one that, like secular, the church rethinks and gradually separates itself from. I don't think we need those contemporary terms. I think they confuse more than they elucidate.
Is there a problem then with sometimes things getting lost in translation?
Yes, very much so. But the interesting thing about values is that that term was expressly chosen and is used in contradistinction to virtues in all Western languages that I've examined, whether it's French, German, Afrikaans. All of these languages have the term values as a new term, really, appearing relatively recently in the history.
I just want to take Europe as a case in point, because we've had the Treaty of Lisbon, and it had been very controversial. First of all, a lot of countries ratified it without a referendum. And some countries, take Ireland as a country, for instance, had a referendum, the people voted no. And then they voted again, and they voted yes. But they voted no because they didn't like certain aspects of what was in the treaty. And a lot of people were afraid that, you know, we've had thousands of years of Christianity in Europe. There was a fear, and there is a fear in Europe as a whole, that there is a minimising of religion in the public square, as it were. Mm. Would that be a feeling that you would have?
Oh, I think it's very clear. I don't even think the point's debatable that there's a minimization of religion in the public sphere. I think that that is an ideological minimization. It's not by chance. If one follows the English term secularism from its origins in 1851 in the writings of George Jacob Holyoake, the man who's credited with and takes credit for the term, you can see there's an express program attached to the term secularism. It is to minimize the public role and importance of religion. And that program set out some of the things it wanted to achieve, one of which was the change in education from one that had religious content to one that didn't. Well, you can see that this program of secularism has been a step-by-step march through time and has been largely successful. When the term, therefore, secularism is used as if it can be made friendly, this is a big mistake. So I don't agree with my countryman Charles Taylor, for whom I have great respect, in his choice of the term open secularism, or his use of the term open secularism in the report that he and his fellow academician Bouchard did in their Taylor-Bouchard Commission in Quebec. I think to embrace the idea of open secularism is a mistake. What we really want to do is start with a new set of language terms which we can. There's no reason language isn't written in stone. It obviously evolves. It has, in some respects, plasticity. And what we need to do is think of better language categories for articulating the role of religion in relation to the public square. And secularism and open secularism, laicism, open laicism, these are not the terms we want to use.
It's a tough battle then if there is this minimization. How does the church and churches, how do they combat that in the face of governments and states?
Well, because I think the language that's of diversity, multiculturalism, and even pluralism can be used to provide a basis for fair treatment. Once you start off, as I believe you need to, by saying everybody's a believer, everybody's in belief communities, they may be atheistic and agnostic believers, but they have their own communities. And then you recognize that these communities of belief, whether they're atheist or agnostic, should not dominate the religious belief communities. What we need is a language of modus vivendi. How is it we can live together with disagreement, respecting these different belief systems, rather than have one trump the other? More and more, it is the case in contemporary jurisprudence that what we see are claims of rights between different belief communities in which one seeks to dominate the other and drive it out of any public place. This is certainly the case with the same-sex marriage litigation in various countries. And I, for one, believe that the law needs to find better ways to articulate how to live together with disagreement than give one group the dominant hand.
Looking at one's own beliefs in the public sphere, it seems that it's becoming increasingly difficult to make your own choices. I say that, I remember there was a case in the UK where a woman was working for an airline and she was wearing a cross on duty, and they said to her, sorry, your cross is offending others, please take it off. She refused. She said, well, this is part of my belief system, I don't want to take it off, and she was hereby suspended. It does seem that for people, it is becoming increasingly difficult for people to make their own choices, to say, yes, this is what I want to put on, what I want to wear, this is what I want to show.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that case, because I actually worked on it. of all the cases you could
well,
have...
Well, that's interesting.
of all the cases you could have chosen, this wasn't set up ahead of time, I can assure anyone who's listening to this. That's an interesting example. I mean, it is the case sometimes that contemporary cultures, and the UK is a good example, they'll give recognition to certain religious practices and groups and deny it to others. And there's a puzzling anti-Christian movement at the moment that one of the speakers in the conference the other day, one of the introducers, described as Christophobia, a kind of fear of Christianity. And it's very strange. There's a cultural fear of Islam, which seems to grant them access as a community to more and more areas. But there's a religious fear. So note the distinction I made there, a cultural fear of Islam and a religious fear of Christianity. The religious fear of Christianity acts as a block against its incorporation, but the cultural fear of Islam acts as a way of giving them access. So you get this parallel thing going on where religions are not actually being treated fairly. The British Airways case involving the cross was a very good example of that, because British Airways had found ways of incorporating hijabs and other, head coverings, veils, and so forth. The red dot of the Hindu religion was incorporated, but somehow the cross was a step too far. I find that interesting.
I'm coming back to, because we were talking about the cross there, and you were talking about the cross being now seen as cultural. Can you explain what you were talking about with regard to that?
Yeah, well, the other presenter, Canadian professor by the name of Solange Lefebvre, she discussed largely the situation within Quebec. My paper pulled the lens back a bit and described the Canadian situation in terms of international developments as well. But one of the points she raised from Quebec was a controversy there with respect to the crucifix being in the legislative chamber. Should the crucifix, which had been in the Quebec legislative chamber for a very long time, should that remain or not? The Taylor-Bouchard Commission suggested that because of the movement of Quebec away from a kind of consensus shared Catholic view, it was no longer appropriate to keep the cross in the legislative chamber. Well, the legislators in Quebec, who would never legislate in favor of the Catholic religion en masse, within hours brought in a unanimous resolution that the cross should stay in the legislative chamber. Why? Because of its cultural significance, and because, as it was put, the cross no longer had religious significance, it was now a cultural artifact, and therefore it should stay. My comment in response to Professor Lefebvre's paper was, how interesting that a religious symbol has to become dead so that it can continue to live. And really, the preferable route might well be for religious institutions to insist that because their symbols live, they should be removed. This is paradoxical, but I think we have to start thinking in these terms, that when our cultures no longer, if it is the case, reflect the belief system that, in a sense, was their roots, is it appropriate for the church to stand in a position of celebration with respect to the new shifts in culture? And the example I gave was the Red Mass. Red Masses are frequently used at the beginning of the judicial year in various countries, and chief of police, the head senior judges, the politicians, and so forth are invited to come to a mass to show the respect of the state and the society for the institution of the mass and the religion. And the question I have is it any longer appropriate to do that in societies where increasingly the politicians and even the judiciary are embracing principles that are antithetical to the religion? I ask it as a rhetorical question, but I think the conclusion from what I've been saying is pretty clear. I think it's not appropriate. I think what it does is actually inoculate citizens against the shifts that have occurred by leading them to think everything's okay because the church and the state are in good cooperation, when in fact they're really not.
Just wanted to turn back to Islam and the debate that's been going on in Belgium and France with regarding headdress and the burqa. What's the situation that actually in Canada, and do we see that spreading into different countries, this idea of countries saying, no, it's not acceptable that you wear this in certain places?
Yeah, this debate is in its infancy, really. It's going to be a nuanced conversation because they're not all the same thing. Some of the head coverings and other are very different from others. We must allow, as indeed Canada has allowed, and I think Canada is a good example of how these things can be accommodated. It's at the forefront of accommodation. I mean, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police some years ago recognized that its uniform, which was a cultural icon, should change to allow Sikhs to wear turbans that were part of the uniform. Now, they designed the turban, not unlike some of the British regiments in India, which incorporated turbans in their uniforms. But Canada did that relatively recently with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. There was a great public outcry about it because people said, ah, no, this is our national symbol. But the fact of the matter is the national symbol changed and incorporated the turban, and no one's lost any sleep over it since. And I think it's a good example of how it should have been tolerated. Now, moving to the burqa, I think a full facial covering is a very different thing than a head covering that leaves the face clear. I think I'm increasingly developing the view, and I have to say I'm not settled on this, but I'd like to think about it more, but I'm increasingly of the view that a full face covering is not appropriate in the public sphere. Yes, it can be claimed that it's religious, but I think what it does is it so cuts people off that they can't be seen. They can't properly engage other citizens in public spheres. So I think I could accept a distinction between a head covering and a face covering, which would allow face coverings in private but ban them in public, and certainly would ban them anywhere where identification by face is important, for example, in the classroom, in airports for security reasons, in banks for security reasons, and so forth, in voting booths. Any of these are places where I think it's perfectly reasonable to require uncovering. However, if this is going to be a controversial set of conversations, but with many of my Muslim friends with whom I've discussed this in various countries, they can accept that distinction as well. And some of the women positively welcome it. So I think I could see us moving towards banning the face coverings and tolerating head coverings. And by the way, I don't think the French have done it right with the Stasi Commission by banning yarmulkes, symboles sensibles with the crosses and the veils entirely. I think that's a mistake, but it represents secularism, which is the attempt to exclude all religious symbolism from the public, which is under the rubric of neutrality in France. I think that's it's not neutral. It's actually anti-religious.
I wanted to finally, just in this part of the interview, just to come back to you as a lawyer and come back to the law in all of this. Mm. And you made a point before in your discourse about law usurping the place religion had culturally, and kind of religion, is it losing its place of jurisdiction? Perhaps you could just go a bit further on that from what you were saying in your address.
Well, of course, if one looks at history, one realizes that one of the marks of a theocratic period in history, that is the rule of the state by the church, if one looks at that, one realizes that that is a period of history marked by the unification of law and religion. When we got away from that, and Dignitatis Humanae, Vatican II in 1965, that's one of the most important documents of that council. It recognized that there was a change that had occurred, in which the state had to the government ought to maximize freedom, and the law needs to be disconnected from religious rule in the public sphere. What's interesting is that now law has become the means of ordering society more and more, and in doing so, it is actually becoming, again, it's unifying law with morals and so forth, telling everyone what they should believe, and I think diminishing associational rights.
I just want to ask you if you can sum up the South African Charter on Religious Rights and Freedoms that you've been working on and are working on.
The South African Constitution has a provision, Section 234, which allows for the creation of additional rights and charters to give greater specificity to the general terms of the Constitution. All constitutions say things such as everyone has the right to religion and association, belief, etc. What this provision allows is for civil society, in this case the religions themselves, to propose a charter that spells out with greater degree of detail what they think is important. And over the past couple of years, I've been privileged to be part of a continuity group of about 8 people working with every major religious group in South Africa to come up with such a charter of religious rights and freedoms. And that's now well along the way, and we hope to go to signatures for that in October, so 2010 of 2010. And to produce, and then take that signed 6-page document, roughly, to the government for it to be passed into law. And it sets out in a very, very dense and important way what the religions believe they contribute to society and what they believe is important. Such things as the rights of parents in relation to education, the right to accommodate dissent in relation to health care and so forth, and whether for physicians or pharmacists. The right to access to sacred lands for some of the tribal groups that can't get to their burial sites and so forth. And those kind of things created by this vast consultation with the religions is a real representation that religions can work together. They can agree on complicated areas. And that flies in the face of what some contemporary thinkers say about religions always being the source of discord and disagreement. It's not true. In South Africa, we've had fabulous cooperation from the most amazingly diverse group of religions, whether they're African traditional religions, Christians, Reformed, Catholic, Baha'i, you name it.